And here is a bulletin from Mexia, Texas, Associated Press. Barbers from Mexia, Fairfield, Teague, Coolidge, Wortham, and Grosbeck, Texas, got a lot accomplished at their meeting, which was just held in Mexia. By unanimous vote, they approved, one, a five-day week, two, they raised the price of haircuts and shaves, and three, they voted to fight communism.
You know, this gives me a terrible picture of what could very well happen in a Texas barbershop. I don't know of anyone who is more vulnerable than a man sitting there with a white cloth around his neck, reading a two-month-old copy of Life magazine, and with this guy standing directly back over his left shoulder with the clippers going, and with that funny wintergreen smell they all have on their breath, you know? And just about the time he starts to clip around your ears, I can just hear him saying, "Say, I'd just like to ask you right now is how do you stand on this problem of integration and allowing known communist sympathizers and known red oriented people to come and talk to the colleges before our youth of our nation?" Now, the other night I was listening to Fulton Lewis Jr. and Mr. Fulton was talking about something that I think should be very, very pounded home to the American. Oh, you say, well, how's this? How's it? Give me, Caleb, will you give me the mirror over there? Caleb, give me the mirror. Okay. How you like that, sir? Oh, I see. All right. That's very easy. Yeah. A little bit around the back there. Yeah. A little close to the air. Yeah. Well, as I was saying there, sir, I would like to ask you, furthermore, how do you feel on the subject of Barry Goldwater? Now, the other day I was sitting here, and I was just talking to my friend over there, Caleb. Wasn't it, Caleb, didn't I just say to you the other day, Caleb, that in 1964, the real problem is going to be a problem of whether or not the American public is going to really come to understand how both of these things work together. Now, oh, I see you fighting over a little to the left. All right, I'll turn right here. Caleb, will you give me that mirror? Will you get moving over here, Caleb? I'm going to have to whoop you with it and itch your hide. Oh, yes, I have to admit that prices have gone up. You know, prices go up everywhere, and just as much, it's just a little high. Like I was saying to the wife, you know, a lot of folks don't understand that it costs just as much to live to be a barber as it does to be a gas station mechanic. You know how much we have. Well, I was just saying the other day, Barry Goldwater, on the other hand. Mr. Shepherd, I think you are a very rotten person. All right, cut it out. Oh, keep that back there up there. Just keep it. Keep it in line there, because I think we're going to need a little of this before we're through. In fact, we're probably going to have to be bubbling around. What was that line? I'll put you on your mettle. What line said? What is this from? It just suddenly occurred to me. Ruby lips, blowing bubbles, soft and fine. Come on, I'll give you the brass figlegee with bronze oak leaf palm. If you really know basic American literature, you will understand that. Ruby lips, blowing bubbles, soft and fine. I will award the brass figlegee with bronze oak leaf palm for any of you communism fighters who can rise above the gigantic mire of 20th century mediocrity. Just raise your hand and tell me what that's from. Think you're a good American, I'll put you on the medal. You know, If you know, one of the big basic premises of all these people, you know, who are always fighting various isms in our country, is that they assume, of course, that they're better Americans than anybody else. They really know what an American really is. I mean, they genuinely know what an American is. Well, now, that's an interesting thing. I've been trying to figure out what an American is ever since I was born right there, right in the heart of old Chicago. And now, I suppose to... It's funny. Do you know that a lot of people who live in Chicago figure that anybody who was born this side of Cleveland is somehow not quite as American as somebody born the other side of Cleveland? And it starts to peter off about Kansas City on the other side. Oh, yeah, they hear about people in California. You have... I'll never forget some of the beautiful, hard-hitting, dynamic, concrete-fisted editorials that several of the Chicago newspapers did once just on the very idea of California. It was offensive, you know, just California, the whole idea. People with sunglasses on in December, you know, just seemed terribly un-American. In fact, one of the chief sports, you know, for example, if you're a columnist for a London newspaper, well, it is almost as classical as a ballet. It's almost as classical as a Western movie. That if you come for your 2-week trip to New York to cover the UN, it is automatic. It's almost it is automatic. You have to send back 4 or 5 brilliant columns with brilliant new insights. That get to the core of why the American civilization is failing. And how, of course, by default, British civilization is naturally victorious over all us. Now, on the other hand, are you aware that hardly a week goes by? See, this is always the case when somebody is kind of, you know, floundering. They're kind of in trouble. You can see this everywhere, that the Met fans are not so much Met fans, but anti-Yankee fans. Now, you notice this, for example, in the Post the other day. Of course, the Post is by definition a Met fan paper, just by definition. I mean, the underdog is just by definition. I don't know what they're going to do when the Mets win 17 straight National League pennants. They're really going to be in trouble. But nevertheless, the other day it says, go, 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 Mets! Yanks get cool welcome! They tied it together. It's a very interesting thing there, that they're not independent. They're interrelationary there. Well, this is always the case. And you'll find that as the Mets lose more games, the anti-Yankee element in the Met fan will become stronger and stronger, because he can't really holler so much after a while for the Mets. You can only holler against the Yankees. Like a vote for the Mets is a vote to down Bobby Richardson. Funny bit. Well, you know, are you aware? Now, I don't know whether you get much of a chance to read Chicago newspapers, but I'll tell you this, that hardly a week goes by but what a Chicago newspaper doesn't have a column from one of the more incisive local novelists, poets, playwrights, satirists, columnists, cartoonists, et al., on his week's visit to New York, and how he found the New York culture absolutely empty, devoid of all meaning. And of course, one guy made the salient point, well, they don't have the lake. Well, that's true. That I cannot argue with them. You know, having lived in both places, they do have the lake. Now, to raise your hand and say, we have the ocean, that's not quite true. You do not have the ocean. Fire Island has the ocean. Now, that doesn't mean that you have the ocean. I know guys that lived in Manhattan for over 19 years and haven't seen the ocean. I mean, you get about, it's very simple to do that. You know, you can see a little bit of the East River once in a while if you get out there on 57th Street. At the right angle, you might see it. But I don't know of very many columns that have been written, say, by hard-hitting, incisive novelists from New York, exposing Chicago for the sham and the facade that it is, you know, tearing down the plastic bricks. Well, why? Well, we just assume that it's a sham and a facade. We don't have to have a column to tell us this is true. You know, that's one of the wonderful thing about America, especially about... Oh, speaking of shams and facades, this is WOR, AM and FM, New York, and we have with us Mandarin House. Now, I think tonight I'll do a commercial for Mandarin East. There, of course, I assume you know about Mandarin House. Mandarin House is down on 13th Street between 6th and 7th. And the other Mandarin restaurant in town is Mandarin East, which is operated by Emily Kwa. And I would like to make a specific recommendation, because many people have never tasted Mandarin food. And I want to make a specific recommendation that I found great. If you drop into Mandarin House, which Mandarin East, rather, which is on 2nd Avenue, just north of 57th Street, a beautiful, it's a little jewel of a restaurant, beautiful little restaurant. It's magnificently, the decor is beautiful. I would suggest you try twice prepared, they have about five words, it's roughly translated, twice fried pork. It's wonderful. It's a Mandarin dish that is great. They have a bar, and I think you'll find it worthwhile. Okay? Fine. You know, it's a funny thing. I was going through a lot of old junk today. You ever go through the scene where you're throwing out old junk, and you're throwing out like 5,000 old receipts of stuff you couldn't remember ever buying? And I have in my pockets, I'm a great piece of paper collector, little chunks of paper, you know? And I must have 17,000 chunks of paper, little pieces of paper, like the back end of a match cover, a little piece torn off of a napkin. And each one of them has a telephone number written on them. And you know what I think I'm going to do? Someday, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. It might be very interesting. I'm going to put about 17,000 of these phone numbers in a glassine envelope. And I will submit them to the listener who would volunteer and undertake to make all the calls in one day to find out who's on the other end of those numbers. Because I haven't got the guts to do it. After all this time, I'm afraid if I call, "You son of a gun, I've been waiting 17 months for the call." Either that or, "Who? What? Are you still around?" You know, that's even a worse call. So who can prove to me that there are many listeners who have no phone numbers to call. Now, that's quite true. You know, hardly anything is sadder than a guy with a phone in his pad and nobody to call up. Well, I will make available to you, on approval, of course, this collection of wonderful, enigmatic, mystery phone numbers. We'll call it that. It's a wonderful new game you can play, is dial the mystery phone number and try to figure out what the devil it was about. And think of the fantastic plot you've got here, really. Do you know that I know a guy? I'll tell you, talking about phone numbers, I'm going to tell you an insane scene that I one time was not a witness to, but I heard about from one of the great participants in it, literally a great participant. There was a guy I met in the Army, and he looked like an ordinary guy, you know. He was a straight type guy, and he was just a guy. So he announced one day, we're way down in the Everglades, he announced one day that he's having a crummy time trying to get a three-day pass. And he says this chick that he was married to is coming all the way from San Francisco to visit him on a three-day pass. And so, people sitting around there. And when you're in a situation where you really are controlled and can't get out, you wind up talking about things that ordinarily you wouldn't talk about. You really do. And somebody said to him in casual conversations, "How did you ever meet her anyway?" Not giving a darn, you know. Just said it, see. "How did you ever meet her?" Expecting, "Well, I was working in this office, or I was going to school, she was in a biology class." You know, they're all routine. He says, "Well, you know, if I told you, you wouldn't believe it. I am very embarrassed when I tell about this." And immediately everybody, about five bunks around, said, "What?" You know, they could see this wild scene going on. You know, that you can meet girls in a lot of places and a lot of positions, I can tell you. So immediately everybody immediately says, "Well, what? And then the next thing that comes out, he says, "Well, listen," he says, "you promise when she gets here that you won't say anything about it." And so, okay, all right, what is it? So the guy goes on to tell a story. He says one night he went to this party in San Francisco. And the party, you know, it's one of these parties where they have fun and games, you know, the kind of stuff where people guess things. They have games called Truth. They have games, you know, where people ask questions of one another. You got to tell the truth and all that stuff. They, you know, the fun and games type party. He says, and they're really a pain in the neck. And he's there, and he had about three drinks. And the next thing they had was this business of truth and consequences. Well, I hate that game from the beginning. And he says, boy, let me tell you, I break out in a hive when anybody talks about truth and consequence. A rotten game. So, and anybody who hates those games never can play them well. Really, you have to have a streak of almost insensate childishness that runs through your knot-headed mind to appreciate these games. Do you know that I know at least a half a dozen expert panelists who have made a fortune by doing nothing but playing these little whoopee games on television? You know, like guess the number. Guess what fist has got the M&M in it. You know, and guess who's playing a kazoo? You know, that kind of thing. And they all said, oh, wait for me. Oh, I want to say, oh. They raise their hand, you know. Well, every last one of those knuckleheads, I know at least six of them, believe me, are not acting at all. That is their intellectual level. They reach no higher. They aspire no higher. And all of their life, they never got anywhere. And all of a sudden, kiddie games became a genuine grown-up profession. And at last, they fell in. Can you imagine a guy who's a great block man? He's the greatest block builder in his block. You know, he builds great things out of blocks. Well, what are you going to do? You can't get rich doing that. Can't even earn a living. Well, one day, they're going to have this giant television show where Gary Moore is the MC over a lot of people who build stuff with blocks. You know, like half-baked actresses and two-bit comics. And the next thing you know, all the block makers are going to come into the room. They're going to, oh, Gary, I think I got a Gary. You know, this, oy. Well, these people really are at their intellectual level. So this guy was, what's the matter in there, fellow? Said, all right, it's all right. So the next thing that he goes on to say, he says, you know, I'll tell you, I hated that kind of game. And so naturally, I'm terrible at it. I can't play these games. So I'm always getting the consequences. He says, that's it, you know, so all right. So one day I'm drinking, we're playing the thing, and come on, knock it off. So finally everybody says, you got the consequences. Charlie gets the consequences. Okay, what are the consequences? He reaches in the hat and pulls out the thing, and it says, open up the San Francisco telephone directory, run your finger down page 498, and it was just a page selected at random. It says, run your finger down page 498, with your eyes closed, and at the point where your finger stops, dial that number. And if a girl answers, make a date with her. Well, you've already seen the end of the story. This guy puts his hand at 498, he runs his finger down with his eyes shut, and then he says, okay, what is it? Oh, let's see, all right, Sycamore 7, 6SJ, 7GT, all right. Oh, shut up, you guys. You think it's a fun, crying out loud. Well, he dials a number, and this chick says, hello. And all of a sudden, the fun and games changed completely. The complexion of everything changed. This guy says, hello. She says, what is it? He says, look. All right, I'm going to level with you. Here's the story. So he had a date with this chick. She came out to the party, and here it was 3 years later. How do you like that scene? Well, now, this I am making available to you. You do not know who is on the other end of Shepard's phone numbers. You do not know. And so to the listener who can guess what... All right, I'll tell you, we'll have to put it on a contest basis. Americans never go for anything unless you put it on a contest basis. All right. Let's see. We'll have to give you a contest. But give to the listener who can first tell me the name of this song. Which, that is the $50,000 free mystery song. Be the first in your neighborhood. Okay. Now, we'll give you one clue. It is not Over the Bounding Main. Okay? Nor is it, one more clue, this is clue two, it is not Columbia, the gem of the ocean. Hold it. Don't give them too much rope. All right. Just think, phone numbers on approval, just like stamps used to be sent to you on approval. If you do not have immediate satisfaction, just send them right back, and we'll send them to some other sucker. Now, it's a funny business, though. I'm throwing all this junk out, And among other things that I am throwing out, I came across a notebook which I kept when I was in Nigeria. And this notebook, it's funny, I'm looking at the notebook here, and I kept a notebook. It wasn't quite a diary. It was a notebook of things that I felt, which is quite different from a diary. You know, a diary usually says, this morning, took trip to museum, saw so-and-so, 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 wrote letter off to L, that kind of thing. Well, this is really just a notebook where I put down impressions of things that I wanted to remember, and then I immediately forgot about the notebook. Well, which says something about life there, too. But I took this notebook out today, and I looked at this thing, and for a minute, it didn't occur to me what I was referring to, because when you're in a place and you see all these things, you write in a kind of a shorthand, because you forget that one day you will not remember, you know, and you just sort of write it down. Well, here, I'm trying to tell you what heat does to people. And this is in relationship to an earlier program, which we were talking about. You remember the program where we got onto the thing about how a place will change even your morality? Whether you know it or not, or whether you want it to or not, it will. With the heat, with the kind of sand there is, with the kind of leaves there are, with the sort of caterpillars that crawl over your shoe. All of these things will combine to change you into another kind of person. And I was in a place, I've got the name of it here, here it is, Bagadi. Yeah. Well, now this is a place, Bagadi, Bagady, is a place that is closer to the equator than Lagos, and is south of Lagos on the Bay of Guinea, or the Gulf of Guinea, if you prefer that. Now, I will first have to tell you what kind of a place the Gulf of Guinea is. It is one of the most interesting-looking seas I have ever seen. The sea comes rolling in and is almost frighteningly innocent-looking, because the combination of the white sand on the beachhead and the kind of sun that shines down 2 or 3 degrees north of the equator combines to make the sea look almost like milk. It is not blue. It is not the color of the sea off Coney Island, which is a kind of slate gray. Sometimes gets a little green, sometimes a faint blue, but mostly gray. No, this sea looks almost white. And it's an illusion, of course. Water is, in a sense, an illusion. Water is essentially a transparent liquid. It is really a reflective medium, that it reflects everything around it, and that's what causes the color to be what it is. So the blue sea is literally reflecting the blue of the sky, and that's why you see it blue. But the sun on the sky in Africa, right after noon, 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the sun doesn't stop. There is no one place where you say, there's the sun. It's like the whole sky is the sun. Oh, boy, I'll tell you. And it just comes down, Ed. It just comes down. It hits you on top of the head with great big hammers. Well, the sea reflects the sun, and at the same time, the bottom of the sea there happens to be sand, and very white sand. So you wind up with the sea looking as though it were a sort of skim milk. And it kind of rolls up in great long combers. Just long rolling combers. And it rolls up, and it looks very innocent in this little white foam, and then it recedes back, and that sun is beating down, and that heat has got a hold of everything you own, and those palm trees are sort of hanging down, and behind you there are these huts that are sort of conical huts made out of rattan and bamboo and palm leaves. Water's coming in. Well, that's Bagadi. And I'm walking along this beach, and I met on the beach a guy who was an Englishman. He had been in Nigeria, in that area, for many years, working for some kind of company there, some sort of paint company or something. But anyway, he was just an Englishman, you see. And we're walking along the beach and talking about the sharks. Now, there are few places, I don't know why, whenever I read about sharks, I don't know why they ever
why they continually ignore the Gulf of Guinea or the Bay of Guinea. They always talk about the sharks along the Great Barrier Reef. They always talk about the sharks in certain parts of the Pacific. But the legendary sharks along that area are truly legendary. Apparently, these sharks have been known to come up and just leap right out of the water, 37 feet into the inland, bite off 1,400 pounds of bananas and leave right off of a tree and go again. You know, that kind of thing. They're just giants. And all the natives in this area are fishermen. They fish out of long, thin, the most graceful dugout canoes I've ever seen in my life. And these canoes are dugouts, literally. They're dugout of a long, you know what a dugout canoe is, but these are long ones. These must be sometimes, they're very in length, but the ones that I saw that were being used for sea work, some of them are used in the Niger River, but these were long. These were probably 30 feet long. And sometimes as like 4 feet wide, carved out of a gigantic tree. Well, they soak these in salt water for a long time, and then they dry them. And then they cover them with some kind of a pitch. It's some kind of a black stuff that comes out of trees. So they're black colored. And then they paint over the entire length of them in big white swirls and red swirls. They'll paint big red eyes on the front of them. Big white swirls run all the way back. And they'll name them like a very truly love. They'll name them in big white English letters on the side, or something like, Never Trust a Woman. Boat. Yeah, that's a great name for a boat. Never Trust a Woman. Or Trust Only a Few. Was one of them. Name that. Or, all kinds of names, wonderful names. And about 10 guys will get into these things at once. They'll push them out, run like mad. The big combers and it'll push them all back up on shore. Then they'll get the thing pointed again. They'll run. As soon as the wave goes out, they'll run like mad, pushes them back again. And finally, they get the thing going, and a wave will take them 15 feet up in the air. They're paddling like mad with their little wooden paddles. They're insanely paddling straight out to sea, paddling, digging in. And finally, they'll get going, and there'll be about three of these things go out, finally make it. And they'll be maybe a couple of hundred yards out from the beach where the water has stopped being big combers and is now comparatively calm, and they'll put up a little dirty, rotten, crummy sail that is a very crummy looking, like cheesecloth that's been used to clean a lot of old Oldsmobiles. And they'll put this thing up, and they'll start floating away, and they're going down, way down the coast someplace to fish. And they will be out 3 days out to sea, never come back. And boy, is that a sea, I'll tell you. And they tell the stories about sharks. When the guys are launching their boats, sometimes two or three of them will get belted at one time while they're launching. Oh, yeah, they're, oh, boy, these babies just lay offshore there, and they're about 28 feet long, and they're long, white, and cool. And they just lay there, and they strike like lightning. Well, this kind of a place, of course, does different things to people. It is not quite the same as, let's say, Queens. Not at all. No, not a bit of it. It's a very little very little parallels Queens and Nigeria. Very, very little. Perhaps the only thing that they have in common is that they occupy roughly the same planet. And that's about all. Other than that, wow. And a few of the same physical laws obtain, like gravity. You know, they there's no question they have gravity there. You fall out of a tree, you fall out of a tree. Things like everybody there, unless you've been around the sharks too long, you have 2 feet ordinarily. That's about as close as you get to the actual having anything in common. They have 2 ears, but all the while at sea, and it just looks great. You lie on your back there, you know, and you think, oh boy, I'm gonna go down. Well, the only hooker of it is that they say around there that they lose on an average of 1 to 5 people a day. Life is very different in many parts of the world. And people laugh about it when they say, oh, yeah, so we lost many people. Many people in the sea. Stay away, water. Water no good, sir. No, water no good. Wait a minute. I'll tell you, my aunt one day, she went, whoop, gone. Aunt gone like that. Well, it is very different, you know. They lose, well, they don't lose them to sharks. They have an undertow that has been known to draw entire African villages right into the water. It's like the ocean itself comes out and grabs you. Whoo! Down you go, right into the water, and they've been carried as far away as Portugal in 15 seconds, underwater, all the way. Holy smokes, you know, and you get so that you're afraid to go down there and just stick your foot in the water. You think either a giant fist is going to come out and grab you, it's the ocean itself, the Atlantic Ocean grabs you by the foot, or something with teeth that runs all the way back to its stern, you know, start eating you like a corn on a cob. Well, well, you know, it produces a different thing, and then the sun is coming down there. Now, you want to get to the point of my somewhat sinister and very, very enigmatic note. This Englishman, while we're walking along and the beach there, and he'd been there like 10 years, and I said, "What does this heat do to you after a while? I mean, well, how do you get? I mean, gee, I feel like I all the time I was there, I felt kind of half sick. It's sort of sick, you know, it's just like something wasn't working right. I just felt a little sick all the time. And of course, if you're there a year or so, I suppose even if you're there a couple of months, you get over. But other things begin to set in. And he said, well, actually, old chap, many things happen, actually. It reminds me of my chap Heatherstone. I had a friend named Heatherstone in Ghana, actually. He's in Ghana there. He was working for Shell, you know, Shell Oil in Ghana. And the heat, actually, you know, and man has very little energy for much else, actually, but in heat, you know, it was not much energy, actually. And this chap was in Ghana. And his wife was getting very irritated with him. He just didn't have no energy at all, actually. And so one day she announced to him that she had taken a lover, you know. She's taken a lover, you know, a man from Luxembourg who just arrived. She's taken a lover. And I asked Henderson, I said, "Henderson, old man, this is actually a dirty deal, you know. It's not a very good show, actually." Oh, and Henderson says to me, actually, Fred, no, I'm very relieved, actually. It takes a lot of pressure off me, you know. I'm very relieved. I guess it's all right. It takes a lot of the pressure off me. Well, we walked along a while there, and I began to realize that that the world of Graham Greene is not exactly the world of Babylon. and if you wrote a play about that, no one would believe you. They'd say nobody acts like that. Oh no. When you're in Ghana and the temperature's 104 and you've been there 9 years, I suspect you do not quite act the same as you do on McDougal Street. I'm inclined to. So I looked at this little note. My note reads, you got the tape? What? Oh, that's not for me, huh? You got the little note here. It says, "Men in tropics have no energy whatsoever. Relate incident of Ghana. Friend of Luxemburger, whose man approved of wife's lover." Who actually, you know. Of course, I know what he was thinking. He carried it a little further, and I said, "Well, what about the guy who was the lover?" He said, "Another year or two. He's been in the same boat with all of us, you know. He'd been right here in the same boat with all of us, you know. It's damned heat, you know." So he said, "What you say we go to the club and have a drink? Actually, I feel like a little drink, a little gin, maybe, perhaps, huh? What you say to a little gin?" And I thought, well, you know, I've been there now. Well, you know, speaking of enigmatic notes, as long as I'm clearing up enigmatic notes and the symbolism there too, I remember walking along in a long, dark, it seems like a path. Oh, one thing I must say, every time you walk at night in Africa, it seems like you're walking through a tunnel. Yes. And you have never, I repeat, never seen a moon of the kind that shines when it is full over Nigeria. It is impossible to describe. It really is. That moon is so bright. It has such a strange color. It's not the color of our moon. It has such a strange color and texture that it honestly gives you the sense that something alive is sitting up there. Something alive is looking at you. And you know that many of the little subtle ins and outs of religions and so on in different parts of the world are related to their vision of nature itself. And so the moon plays a greater part in religions, in many, or if not religions, at least beliefs in many parts of the world that they, it just doesn't play here. It just doesn't enter that kind of, there is a fear often of the moon, particularly in places like Nigeria. Many people fear the moon. But when you walk at night in Nigeria, it's as though you're walking through an endless succession of closets that have no walls, but you're nevertheless in a closet. Very, very odd feeling. Well, one night I'm walking alone through the closet there, and I'm trying to grope my way back to the compound. You know, it really you know, it's not often that you come back to your hotel room, if you can call it a hotel room, and the hotel room is lit by a candle. It gives it a very different feeling too to the world, and I'm groping my way back to the candle, and I hear coming out of this place, it's just a little shack with screen on it, I hear CW coming. Well, I see CW, that's code. And I go to the screen door and I look in. I don't think I've told this story, have I? I go to the screen door and I look in, and there is a guy sitting in there, and he's got a radio set, an ordinary receiver, just like you have, just an ordinary AM receiver. This is not a shortwave receiver. And he is sitting there copying CW. He's just sitting there, and he's got a pair of shorts on, and he's writing down CW. He's just writing it down. And the guy is writing down, I'm listening to the code, and it is in English, and he is copying news. He's hearing, like, the first item, something like, can you follow that, what I'm saying? Well, what I said was, in Cairo today, dot, dot, dot. So he's sitting there copying news. And I don't want to interrupt him. When a guy's copying CW, don't interrupt him. So I watch him for about 10 minutes. And then I go back onto my pad. And this is the first time that I have done this. I dig through my junk and I take out my little transistor radio. And this is about the second or third night I'm there. And I turn the transistor radio on. And I'm listening right on the broadcast band. You can only hear one or two stations. You hear the Western Nigeria station, and you hear the Eastern Nigerian station. Maybe you hear two stations. And right there in the low end of the broadcast band, at about 560 KC, is this gigantic CW signal just blasting in. Just blasting away. Well, it is a local CW station that is in effect, it's a press wireless station. It's the way they get their news. They're getting news back and transmitting it on to another part of the country, and it's on the regular broadcast band. So I'm sitting there copying the news, getting it in CW. Well, this of course is totally un-American. Most of you wouldn't even know what I'm talking about. I'm talking by code, and for that brief night sitting there, I was drawn back into the world of pure symbolism. Now, the world of pure symbolism is a very interesting world and a strangely pure world. Most of us, when we talk, your talk, now your voice combines many things. First of all, your voice tells other people what sex you are automatically. You listen to somebody and you say, well, that's a woman's voice or it's a man's voice. Instinctively, you hear this and you don't even say to yourself, it's a woman or it's a man. You just know it's a woman or it's a man. And you form a whole series of pictures, images, and so on, based on I'm talking to a woman or I'm talking to a man. Then, on the other hand, inflection in your voice changes meanings. And inflection is almost always unconscious. And so you say, well, I don't know. Well, you said something. Or you could say, well, I don't know. And all these little inflections have meaning. Well, in code, in CW, there are no inflections. And it is very interesting to talk to somebody totally removed from all of the various side communicative effects that you have at your command and have to talk in pure idea. Well, when I'm a kid, I was about 17. It was the first time I ever learned about this. It's a kind of anonymity that most people never enjoy in their lives. Talking to somebody with him not even able to know whether you're a man or a woman or what. So I'm on code, and I began to get, you get so that you're all attuned to symbolism. You don't even think in terms of words anymore. And I'm sitting there one night after having been on CW for about, maybe a year or so, just completely immersed in it. I have a 45 word per minute certificate, and this code is, I'm sitting there in the field of crickets, and they're all talking back and forth, and I'm talking to guys. And right in the middle of all this, I'm talking to a guy, and I say to him, my name is da-da-da-da-dit-da-da-dit. That's J-E-A-N. Well, he came back to me, and he started to send this peculiar stuff to me. He was under the impression I was a woman. And so I said, oh, well, I came back to him enigmatically. Well, do you know that we sat in the middle of the 40-meter band, and this guy tried to seduce me by code for over 4.5 hours? It started at about 8 o'clock at night, and we are talking all the way past midnight. I tell you, to talk 4.5 hours on code, that's a lot of CW, Dad. And this guy is getting very chummy. He's going along there. He's going along there, and I can just see him crunched over his keys, sweating there. He's in Cleveland and I'm in Chicago. He's sweating away there. He figures he's nearing home base. He's going like mad. And finally, I leaves the guy after 4.5 hours with the totally enigmatic, ambiguous note. Well, I'll see you sometimes around the band. And that's it. I just left it hanging there. One of the very few times in my life I have been totally anonymous and have been able to put on the total put on, the total put down, you know, the total put down. Ambiguity is a wonderful weapon.